Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
Also Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
It's cold outside. It's cold in the basement.
These blankets help. It's cold outside.
You're welcome, everybody.
That always happens.
Always. Literally always.
I live my life in song.
It's a true story.
You guys, this girl, once again, pampers me. I gotta say, it's a beautiful, nice, chilly Saturday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
I just arrived with a preheated throw, full cup of coffee, and a beautiful birthday present. I am now proud to say I am now officially part of the Stanley family.
Yay, I got her.
My first ever. I'm a Stanley virgin.
I had to karate chop an old lady to get it, but it happened. Just kidding. I would literally never.
She would not.
I did have to go to more than one store.
That's her dedication to her best friend.
That's dedication right there.
Mm-hmm.
She deserves 93 Stanleys.
God love ya. We have two new Patreons.
Yes, we do.
Glenda Hernandez.
Yeah, Glenda.
Like Glenda. Ooh.
Glenda, sort of Glenda. Like Elphaba and Glenda from the new Wicked movie. Speaking which I'm
of,
so, oh my
who
God.
Else saw that trailer?
I can't
Super
even.
Super Bowl Sunday.
I'm so excited.
First commercial yep. was Wicked.
Yep.
Hello.
Hello is yes. Right.
Watching that.
Hello is yes.
Done.
Okay.
Hello is yes.
We also have Malia Brooks.
Malia. Oh, that's gorgeous.
Woo, Malia.
Hi, Malia.
Okay, Malia. What you guys are is Kelpies. What's a Kelpie, you ask?
I didn't ask yet, but I was planning on
it. Here's the information that nobody asked for. Kelpies are Scottish folklore critters.
Oh, I love that already.
I know. And they are shape-shifting water spirits, usually appearing as a horse, luring all the bad people to a watery grave.
I am jealous.
I'm pretty obsessed.
Those are phenomenal.
I know. So I read about that and was like, Glenda Done. And Malia, yep, that fits your fits your description.
I am jealous of you too, Glenda and Malia.
And then I think we should probably dive right into this because she's a long one. Like, I still have like such a hard time like wrapping my head around this, and it gets so bad. And this just makes me cringe and cry for these poor families that had to go through all of this, and these poor people. I mean, like, we went on like a tangent about this our last episode, but you know, we care for people with dementia all the time, and like, you build relationships with these people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, elderly people have been around for so long and have such incredible stories, and like, they're such valuable.
We're in the business that also everybody, for our residents and our patients, no one strives to live their life to go into a nursing home.
No.
Right?
Nobody expects
like,
that.
We earn our living and have our careers in the business where that's not where anyone hopes to end up.
No.
You know? And so we always strive to like make it the best and mm-hmm. pleasant and as home-like as possible, knowing that we aren't your home. But,
right.
and we know that no one thought that that's where they'd have their golden years and end of life and whatnot. And then to just have these two and just squash it, make it so demeaning.
Yeah.
And it's just.
It just reduces these people to just like these empty shells. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. And it's like, that's not what these people are.
Right.
That's not what these like lovely elderly people who have lived, you know, in many cases, beautiful, full lives and
right.
have families that love them and remember them as they once were.
Yeah.
And it's just such a sad, sad thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to just jump right back into this. Welcome back. So where we left off, Gwen Graham had grown up in this abusive home. We kind of talked about her childhood. As she grows up, she leaves her home in Tyler, Texas. She starts anew as a CNA at Alpine Manor Nursing Home, which is a facility in Grand Rapids, Michigan. There, she meets fellow CNA Kathy Wood, who also grew up in this abusive home, or so she says. And the two bond immediately, and they begin this love affair.
You say, or so she says, so it's, I caught on to that.
Yeah.
I caught on to that.
So
subtle.
We are going to talk about the twists and there's turns and there's manipulation and there's a lot of stuff that we sort of get into about how crazy both of these ladies are. Mm-hmm. And what the you know, running theory is about, like, who was kind of the ringmaster and who was not so much the ringmaster. So the two sort of like give conflicting reports, but ultimately they decide that to cement their toxic bond,
oh boy,
they would begin murdering patients mm-hmm. that they cared for together. And they took their first victim together by suffocating her. And this was a 60-year-old woman with advanced Alzheimer's disease.
Which we've gotten into last time about the most devastating. And I said that before I even knew patient number one.
Yes. Trigger warnings for this episode include sexual abuse and elder abuse. We kind of left off right after they had committed this first murder. And while these two ladies give like conflicting reports on who did what and who was like the right. puppet master.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
The more I'm reading about it, the more it seems like Kathy sort of drove this.
Really?
And was like the puppet master of the situation. And we'll get very heavily into it.
I can't wait to find out why.
And this does not excuse Gwen's behavior at all. But I'm just saying that to provide a little bit of insight into like their dynamic. So a lot of the source material for this episode is coming from this book called Forever in 5 Days by Lowell Caulfield. And it's a very in-depth look at both of their lives and their upbringings, their relationships. It also includes like dialogues that are reported to have happened and things that are, you know, taken right from the trial. It's super, super interesting. Mm. So Forever in 5 Days by Lowell Caulfield. So go look it up. I'll also link it in the show notes for everybody. So in this book, I had found that prior to getting together with Gwen, Kathy had actually engaged in an affair with another CNA at work by the name of Dawn. And she and Dawn had sort of this affair like on the down low. There's mention that Kathy and Ken were still together at this point. She was still married okay, at this point.
I was about to say she's loving this newfound freedom, but mm-hmm. I guess not.
So Ken at one point, I guess, might have even caught them together.
Sorry, Ken.
When they were having like together one-on-one time. And I bring this up because Dawn later reported that a lot of what Kathy had told her was seemingly untrue. Like she would say, she would tell Dawn, Kathy would tell Dawn these like outlandish stories that Ken was really abusive to her and her daughter, and that Ken forced her to gain weight because he force fed her food,
what?
And that Ken had sexually assaulted her at one point.
Oh, dear.
So we don't know for sure, obviously, what happened, but there's absolutely no evidence that any of that happened. And later on, Ken actually goes on to absolutely deny all of these claims. Mm-hmm. And their daughter, whose name is Jamie, by the way,
aww,
who's grown now, has absolutely no memories of anyone being abusive, of her father being abusive to either one of them. Right. And if anything, Kathy was the one who was abusive to both of them. She was negligent with her daughter.
Right.
And she was verbally abusive and manipulative with Ken. Also, Dawn goes on to state down the line that Kathy had told her at one point during that relationship, "I just don't care about Jamie. It sounds terrible, but I don't know. I just don't care." End quote.
It's awful.
About her daughter, that's about awful. Her 7-year-old daughter.
That's awful.
So for me, that's like a sociopath
type
thing.
Of course. Emotionally detached.
I mean, for a mother to say that about her child is just, for me, that's insane.
I mean, I know you see that in a lot of postpartum depression and
you
and
do
psychosis
and psychosis and things like that. So you're right. It could absolutely very much
but
be.
But I mean, this is also 7 years later.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like,
exactly. Yeah. Dawn also noted when the two of them had actually met Gwen and Kathy, like, so Dawn was there and sort of was the one in the friend group to sort of introduce Gwen and Kathy when they started working all there together. So Dawn was there and she had said the first thing that Kathy said to Gwen when she noticed the scars on her arms, Gwen had scars on her arms from self-harm. Remember, I mentioned that she was self-harming when she was in high school. So it struck Dawn as odd that it was the first thing she noticed, and she just very forward, had like no filter whatsoever, and she just like asked her, "Hey, how'd that happen? How'd you get those scars on your arms?" When like it was obvious by looking at them what they were.
Right.
And she was unusually interested in those scars.
Hmm.
And it seemed like a little inappropriate to be like, this is their first interaction.
Huh.
Dawn
right.
is witnessing all of this.
Got it.
When Kathy and Gwen meet. Kathy right. initially, like almost before she even said hello, was like, how'd you get those scars?
What'd you do? What's this?
Exactly. So it just struck her as like unusual. So that's just, again, to provide a little bit more background into that whole moment. So this first murder happens. Now, given that the patient had chronic illnesses, advanced dementia, it was felt that this death was most likely natural. Additionally, with suffocation deaths, it's not uncommon for them to be for there to be like almost no outward signs, like physically, that somebody has been suffocated to death. And they really had no reason to believe that any foul play had happened at the time. So as a result, her death was deemed as natural and was felt to be as a result of some like acute cardiopulmonary event. And an autopsy was not pursued. And autopsies at this level of care are actually quite uncommon because the vast majority of these patients are elderly and a lot of them live there permanently. And with chronic conditions, deaths at facilities like this is like expected, really, right?
Right.
Unless there's some extenuating circumstance, like they have a bad fall right before they pass, or there's...
All within 10 days.
Devin knows.
I know that one very well.
She knows. And typically, families will decline to pursue autopsies most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this whole three-month time frame that I mentioned, where several other murders as well as attempts happen. Now, staff notice right away, as soon as these two girls like get together, they start showing signs that they're extremely into each other, but also very like codependent. Mm-hmm. It's extremely toxic and it's extremely obvious to everybody around them what their dynamic is. So both ladies start calling out of work like regularly to make sure that they're like together all the time. And so it takes on this pattern very quickly that like at least between the two of them, at least one of them is calling out once a week.
Trust me, as a at management level, it doesn't take long to find a pattern of call-outs.
Yeah, no kidding. It doesn't. So between the two of them, they're averaging this like one call-out a week. And then they're often trying to like switch shifts to make sure that when they work, they can be together. And when they're off, they can be together.
Mm.
And they notice that both girls have like scratches and cuts and bruises on their arms and on their chest and like hickeys, just like obvious hickeys.
Right.
They make no attempt to like hide any of this. And these two women were often asked about, like, how did you get so beat up? And, like, what the hell happened to you? And down the line during interviews, they would say that these were the injuries that they would inflict on each other during their
lovemaking situations.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So a strong codependence is forming here. Like,
they
can't function when they're apart sort of situation.
And this is happening fast.
So fast. Like, insanely fast.
Mm.
So during this period, a friend, actually, who would later come forward that she witnessed a physical altercation between Gwen and Kathy during their, like, first months of their relationship, and she said that the two got into a verbal argument and that she witnessed Kathy pulling Gwen back by the hair and, like, slamming her head against a wall or a door or a door jamb or something like that. So lots of volatility, very toxic. There's like fighting and then like passion and it's like these extremes, right?
Wow.
Red flags everywhere. Like,
yeah,
these ladies who were both abused are like now in this cycle of abuse,
codependent abuse upon each other.
Exactly. So it's worth noting at the time at Alpine Manor, the turnover among staff, particularly with nurses' aides, is extremely high. Around the time when Kathy and Gwen were doing their thing, turnover was around 66% among LNAs. So like 60, meaning that 66% of their hired staff would not be considered long-term staff members.
Right.
So extremely high turnover. So this probably played a role a little bit into why they were able to like get away with so much. And we're going to go into some more of their behavior at work, like even outside of murdering people. They're just extremely unprofessional, extremely toxic, very hard to work with. But I think the reason that so much was tolerated for them was that there was very little consistent staff that were in the picture. So it was easy for them to sort of fly under the radar for that reason.
I mean, in that aspect, not a lot has changed.
No.
Right?
That's true.
But I mean, I can only speak for our facility.
Exactly.
it doesn't matter how many bodies of staff members, like how it doesn't matter how many staff we are short.
Right.
You're never just going to keep someone around for to have a body.
No.
To have a body is going to do the job.
But that was the situation in this situation.
Yes, for sure.
And we've had so many more cases that have been like, well, they were desperate for staff. Yes, so they just kept them on and tolerated this, that, and the other thing.
Of course.
And especially like...
I mean, post-COVID, we can see it. Hello.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. So... administration probably didn't really feel like they had much of a choice but to tolerate it because they were, these two were the only, like, and they had really only been there for like a year or two at this point. And they were like the most consistent staff members that were there.
Okay, that's just terrible.
Which is so sad.
That is just terrible.
And there was even one time where Gwen's supervisor had to send Gwen home because she showed up with her, for her shift hammered. She was hammered.
Come on.
And so her supervisor was appalled that she would even think to do, like, I can't believe you're doing this. So she writes her up. She writes a note to the administrator. She sends Gwen home for the night. And she's fully expecting that Gwen is not going to be back.
That,
like, that's
a
fireable offense.
That's automatic termination.
100%. Group C. So she's expecting her. And then the following night, she shows back up. Administration did absolutely nothing.
Wow.
Just kept her on because they felt like they had no choice. How am I going to staff this building if I don't have these two clowns fucking around
yourself.
In here?
Yeah. Hello?
Not back then. No way.
Yeah.
So the irresponsible behavior continues and starts to even escalate during this period. So it's reported that the pair are entering closed rooms and closing the door behind them, being alone together in rooms. Coming back out all disheveled, like, you know what's happening in there.
Right, right, right.
And there's reports that they were caught making out in empty rooms. They would prank their coworkers, like, a lot. And it's not, like, good-natured. Like, we all do little pranks, like, here and there. And, like, sometimes it's, like, good-natured and it's, like, kind of cute. And, like, there's really nothing wrong with that. That's even, like, encouraged. Like, mm-hmm. have fun. Mm-hmm. But they would prank people, like, and include the residents. In it, like that, I read something where they would dress the residents and like put their clothes on backwards.
That's not cool.
That's literally not cool. No. They put someone to bed and have them be back like upside down in bed so that their head is at the headboard and their feet are on the pillow. Like they're doing this to prank their coworkers and be like, haha, now you have to fix that. And it's like,
no, that's resident
safety.
But
that's like a safety issue and dignity. Yes. And so so that's just to highlight that these residents mean absolutely nothing.
They're a game to them.
They're a total game. They mean absolutely nothing.
Wow.
Absolutely nothing. And I mean, that's, people are witnessing this and are like, right. You guys are, this is wild. Like they're getting written up. They're getting all the, but administration is doing absolutely nothing. Like, negligence, abuse.
My God.
I know. Poor Devin is like, my chest hurts. I gotta go. So.
Wow.
After this first victim, Marguerite Chambers, the pair realized that. They realized. So the goal, as we said in the first part, was to spell the word murder, right? Ooh. They planned this. Let's spell out the word murder with the names of our residents that we kill.
So
and
who's
I'm giggling.
Next?
I'm giggling because this is so dumb. They realized after Marguerite and using Marguerite for the word the letter M that they don't have any residents at Alpine with the name starting with the letter U.
They didn't think that out very well.
This is how far ahead these ladies plan. Exactly 0%.
Zero.
Exactly 0%.
Wow.
So. Or at least they didn't have anybody that they could felt like they could physically overpower.
Thank God,
like,
because I mean, little old lady Ursula was just
no.
Sitting
I know.
Duck,
I was thinking. I was like, "Who is you?" When I was reading about this,
yes,
I was like, "It must be Ursula," or I don't know. That was the only
Eugene. It's not. It's not even Eugene because
they have an E.
Oh
my God! So anyway, that's just how much forethought these ladies put into this.
Number one, these. Absolutely. The residents and their families at the forefront of my mind on what they were going through. But mm-hmm. then I'm also like, number one, shame on you, administration, for not catching this earlier. But then I'm also, you know, I'm in the back of my mind, I'm like, I just, I, I, the administrative stuff in the back of my head, I'm just like thinking of just the bullshit that they just put everybody through.
Yes. You know? Isn't that insane?
And I'm just, wow.
Yes.
What they did to the residents, their coworkers, their facility.
I know. So, they had to abandon the plan to spell the word murder.
So now we go from, do they just skip the letter at all?
No.
Like a license plate
No,
thing?
They abandoned it. But
M-R-D-R?
Yes. M-R-D.
Like.
They could just murder.
Eugene could come with the E. I mean, they just skip it.
So they abandoned the plan at all. They're like, right. We can't spell murder anymore. So they start utilizing this phrase between the two of them, sort of based on the old adage, forever in a day. Like, I'll love you forever in a day. So based on that old adage, they would start to say, when they killed one person, they would say to each other, I'll love you forever in a day. When they had killed two people, they would say to each other, I'll love you forever in 2 days. So this was like this little code phrase between them. And they would say it to each other all the time at work in front of people. Nobody would have any idea what they meant by I love you forever in 4 days. Like,
right.
You know, and they would, there's a lot of letters between the two of them that have like love letters and poems, like,
right. So,
you know, using that phrase. Yeah. So that's like their little code phrase that they had for each other.
This is sick.
This
is sick.
So sick. They then set their sights on 95-year-old Myrtle Luce. Myrtle was a woman who suffered from organic brain disorder. Organic brain disorders are a little different than like Alzheimer's dementia. It's a term to sort of describe any cognitive disorder that has an organic cause. Like, so for example, the Alzheimer's dementia is like a degenerative brain disease, right? Organic brain disease is like a traumatic brain injury. So right. A brain injury from trauma or cognitive deficits caused by brain trauma. Or another example would be like long-term drug and alcohol abuse causing this cognitive deficit.
Like Kawasaki.
Right. So it's like a secondary cognitive deficit. So overall, though, it presents very similarly to Alzheimer's dementia and it progresses like other forms of dementia. So in early February, Kathy and Gwen proceeded to pinch Myrtle's nose shut and hold a washcloth over her mouth. And for some unknown reason, they did not keep going until she died. They did not kill her in this moment. So Myrtle survived this initial ordeal. So I'm not sure if maybe somebody walked by, they got spooked for some reason, or they felt like she fought too hard in that moment. We don't know for sure. But that same night, another nurse's aide came into Myrtle's room and noticed that Myrtle had blood coming out of her nose.
Oh.
And the aide cleaned her up. There was really no bruising, no other physical signs. And unfortunately, due to Myrtle's cognitive impairment, she was unable to tell any staff that she had been attacked.
Oh, that's devastating.
How sad is that?
That's devastating. Ooh.
Can you imagine if you would
hurt... No, I can't imagine.
Can you imagine if this was your mother?
Oh, no.
So, next, 77-year-old Donald Randall was another attempted victim of Kathy and Gwen, again in early February. Kathy and Gwen attempted to suffocate him using their typical method with the washcloth and the pinching of the nose. It seems like in this case, however, despite his profound cognitive impairment and aphasia due to a prior stroke, he was able to physically fight back enough
so that
they could not overpower him. They totally underestimated his strength.
I mean, let me tell you, the strength of some of our residents.
Oh,
man.
My gosh. When they want to be, yes, they're throwing hands, tossing hands. So he continues to fight against whoever was attempting to suffocate him. Until they essentially gave up and walked out of the room. And unfortunately, he too was unable to ask for help, unable to report this because, I mean, he had survived this horrible ordeal.
So he survived. So what was the sign that was left behind that he was attacked?
He didn't have any signs, but this was a confession that later came out.
Got it. Okay.
Because Kathy and Gwen later on start talking a lot about all of their attempts, all of their victims, everything. So, days after they attacked Donald Randall, the pair decide to try again with 95-year-old Myrtle Luce.
Oh, no.
And so on February 10th, the pair suffocated 95-year-old Myrtle Luce to death.
Oh, that's awful. That's awful.
Ugh, it hurts my heart. Poor Myrtle. I know.
Gosh.
Again, facility management did not think much of this death because, again, this is a 95-year-old woman with chronic comorbidities, and outwardly there was no sign of injury, no sign of foul play. And other than the fact that she was reasonably healthy before this, they had no reason to believe at the time that anything unusual had happened. So, again, this was treated as a natural death. No autopsy was pursued.
My goodness.
So, it seems
this is
that
so sad.
This is the saddest.
This is so sad.
This is so sad.
Because, like, and you know, when we've experienced residents that maybe we weren't, like, anticipating to pass away,
mm-hmm.
but it looks like maybe they had some kind of event in their bed or something,
right.
you know, and we always just say they passed in their sleep, or, you know, like, because mm-hmm. it's just could be so sudden, and
yes.
that's probably what most likely these staff members are talking about, right, when
mm-hmm.
they come in the next day and poor Myrtle's gone and,
right.
and whatnot, and then it's just, but no, but what these two bitches did,
yes,
like, no, she was brutally murdered,
yes,
and she
exactly.
was suffocated. She
exactly.
didn't pass peacefully in her sleep.
Nope. Nope. Nobody should have to go this way. This is a 95-year-old woman who had made it to 95. 95 years old. A frail, elderly woman who could not defend herself. So, it seems that during the shift when Gwen and Kathy did this to Myrtle, they also had altered some medical documentation. They found this when they reviewed all of the documentation.
What?
So, they had signed other staff members' name instead of their own on their shift documentation in order to, like, distance themselves from having cared for Myrtle at
mm-hmm.
all during that shift. So, obviously, that was easily debunked because they could just look at the schedule and be like, she was working this unit. Why is so-and-so's
right.
initials there?
Thank God for electronic documentation.
So,
now.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, like, so everything was documented on paper back
yeah,
around
yes,
this
it was.
Time.
Yeah.
And when you're a caregiver, you have to document literally everything you do. So you take someone to the bathroom, you have to document it. They pee or poop, you got to document it. You give
yep.
them a bath, put them in their chair, mobilize them at all, how much they eat, you're documenting everything.
Yes.
So nowadays, you know, forging somebody's a EMR like record would be very difficult because you have to log in with your own login
mm-hmm.
and you
and
have
then use
passwords.
Your own passcode.
Yep. Along the way, everything you put in, you have to put your own passcodes in, and it'd be exceedingly difficult
right.
to forge something and get away with it.
Absolutely.
So, but yeah, back then you could, I guess, do that very easily. So on February 16th, staff find another resident by the name of Mae Mason dead in her room. Now, this one did come as a little bit more of a surprise to people. She was stable. She was functional. She did have dementia, but she was seemingly in very good health. She was ambulatory, and only an hour or two prior, an LNA sat with her. She said she had brought her some food. She was eating and drinking. They were talking. They were laughing. She was engaged. I mean, this was a little bit more of a surprise because the LNA had a great interaction with her, like literally an hour before she was found dead. So that, for whatever reason, struck everybody as a little bit odd.
Mm-hmm.
There was no sign of a decline whatsoever, and she wasn't quite as frail, it sounds like, as the other two
mm-hmm.
that had passed. So this surprised people. A bunch of staff, so like when it happened, it was like an off shift, right? So like once everybody heard, oh, you know, oh my goodness, May died, what, like everyone just comes into her room and like looks at her, like
right.
the staff are like coming in and taking a look and be like, oh my god, this is so sad,
right.
So staff are like coming in and like looking. And it's getting around the building that she's passed, and everyone's like coming down to the unit because everybody loved this lady.
Yes, I mean, we do that often.
Here, yes.
Yes.
Exactly. So later on, staff did notice, the staff that were interviewed noticed, huh, actually, Gwen and Kathy were working that night, and they didn't come down to the room. They were the only two that didn't come down to the room and like say goodbye or talk with the nurse or anything.
So, in this type of situation, given that you're a provider that would have this type of situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have had conversations
mm-hmm.
like, hey, Kate, as the provider,
mm-hmm.
you know, how do you feel about this? Should I refer to medical examiner? You know what I mean? Like,
for me,
like, how do you feel about that?
For me, you know, it's tough, right? Because you know, she wasn't without her comorbidities also, but with the history of the LNA just having this like beautiful interaction with her, and literally it was like minutes. Mm-hmm. It was minutes later that she, you know, it was an hour later that she was found dead. Mm-hmm. And for me, with the history and the deaths that have been sudden lately, yeah. I would maybe recommend an autopsy, refer to a medical examiner. You know, and ultimately it is up to the family. You can't force them if they don't want an autopsy. Yeah. But
it, there's even been times too, like, you know, so when we've had situations that have come up, and I mean, I've been on the phone with medical examiner for our county, and, you know, you go through diagnoses, tell me about their death, tell me, and you know, and you just talk about it. But even a lot of times then too, in this setting, you see what comorbidities are there. Because a natural death can happen that quickly. It's less likely for, you know, but it can. It still can.
Absolutely, it can.
So even if you had a provider who's like, I don't know, maybe we should report this. Mm-hmm. Maybe let's refer to a medical examiner, let them decide. Mm-hmm. Being someone who's been on the phone with them, it really is even likely. I could see them in the 80s. I don't know. But now, like, no. Go ahead, release the body. I decline jurisdiction.
Right, exactly.
You know, the family can still pursue. But at least you can
pose the question to them and sort of let them, you know, if they feel like, what do they feel is appropriate in this situation?
Yeah.
So, I mean, for me, I would have maybe brought that up to them and been like, you know, because it would never hurt. You know, what you don't want is for, you know, to wish people have had an autopsy down the road.
Right.
You know what I mean? So again, though, ultimately an autopsy was not pursued for this case. It's around this time that it's noticed that the pair start picking up a ton of extra shifts. So now all of a sudden they're wanting to be at work together all the time. And
getting high off this.
Yeah. So for example, Gwen worked 28 shifts during the month of February. 28. She was only supposed to work 20 shifts. So, I mean, it's like
she worked every day.
Almost literally every day. Almost every day.
Well, there's 28 days in February.
Yes. So literally every day.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unless it's a leap year.
So, and maybe they worked some double shifts too, and that's counting. You know what I mean? I'm not sure. So they would try to schedule the girls. So I think they caught like off shifts, but they would always find reasons to like rearrange their shit and their shifts so that they could always work together. So like so-and-so would switch a shift with somebody else to make sure that they could always work at the same time.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, management did very little to stop this because they were working all the shifts. They were the most consistent staff on the floor. And the turnover rate was so high that they could not afford to lose two more people.
I often will try. There's, you know, I don't want so-and-so on same unit and whatever. Yeah. Sometimes they still find their ways.
Just
and I'm like, what?
Yeah, you're like, how'd this happen?
What?
Damn it. So towards the end of February, another patient by the name of Belle Burkhardt, age 74, was found to have unexpectedly passed in her room. The pair were in the building at the time. And this was, again, not felt to be suspicious. An autopsy was not pursued. Gwen and Kathy then took several days off after this murder, and they did this a couple of times. Like they would kill someone and then take like a couple days off together, always together. And shortly after this, Gwen and Kathy actually had like a friend over one night. Remember Dawn? It was her. And they invite her over for dinner and casually confess that they've been smothering these patients.
You don't casually confess this.
Wait for it. They casually confess that, hey, you know, Mae Mason and Marguerite and this other lady that just passed and Belle, we did that. We killed them. We smothered them. Just casually confesses. And Dawn.
What does Dawn do?
Dawn assumes that the pair are pranking her.
No.
Because they prank everybody all the time.
No.
And they're huge jokesters, and she says there's no way you guys are being serious. You guys are full of shit.
I would have reported that immediately.
This happens a few times with a few different people.
Come on.
I shit you not.
No.
Stay tuned.
You don't joke about, there's a line. They've crossed that line so many times with their pranks.
I feel like,
I'm sorry,
nobody looked at these two women and how unprofessional they were and the things they did, quote unquote, for fun. Pranks like on their residents, using the residents, and thought to themselves, maybe. You know what I mean? Like, nobody thought to just tell someone, literally anyone, an authority. Because, come on. It kills me. It kills me.
Ugh.
So, around this time, in March of 1987, this is when things start to get a little bit more turbulent between Kathy and Gwen. Gwen reports that she sort of started to realize the level of manipulation that she's being subjected to from Kathy, and she's feeling very controlled, she's feeling suffocated, and that she's being manipulated into doing these awful things to people, and can kind of, and then Kathy, in turn, is starting to sort of realize that Gwen is starting to pull away a little bit. So what does Kathy do?
They're turning on each other.
She starts to look for another victim for them to kill together to, like, reignite their fucking gross bond. Edith Cook, a 98-year-old, pleasantly confused woman who was a long-term care resident of Alpine, had not been doing well lately. She was the resident that everybody loved. She was always happy, always cheerful, always smiling. Just like a being of light, even in her elderly, frail, confused state with her cognitive impairments, she is still enjoying life as much as she can. Like, she is just one of those beautifully positive,
yep,
just absolute gems.
Yep.
Everybody loved this woman. It's Edith. Oh, yes. Hi, Edith. How are you? You know, we all have those people, right? Mm-hmm. That are just like, oh, my little spirit animal,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Everybody loved this lady. All of us working in long-term care, you have had, everybody working in long-term care has somebody that they will never forget. Unfortunately, as of late, she had acquired some wounds on her feet that were felt to be like vascular wounds that had become gangrenous. And in the past few weeks, she had had kind of a decline. She was spent, because of the pain, she is starting to spend a lot more time in bed. She's not tooling around in her wheelchair like she used to be.
Yeah.
Gangrene, which...
Oh.
Gangrene is a bacterial infection that can be caused by a number of different bacteria and essentially causes tissues to become, like, necrotic and die off.
I literally... Tangent. Sorry. We were having a break, and mm-hmm. I belong to this thing on social media that's called long-term care nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And the question literally was... What is the worst smell for you in nursing?
Perfect segue.
And someone commented, lower GI bleed, which mm-hmm.
yes,
that's
true. Yes.
But for me, wet gangrene.
Yes.
Wet gangrene, yep. Uh-huh. All the way.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
So perfect segue. I'm glad you said that, because not only is it extremely, excruciatingly painful for people mm-hmm. that suffer from it, it is some of the most distinctive smelling. And the smell permeates everything, and it yes. gets everywhere. And you can do wound care with two pairs of gloves on and a gown, and you will be smelling it in your nostrils still
you
for the rest of the day.
That day when we were in nursing 101,
mm-hmm.
do you remember that day of my clinicals when I came home and
oh, yeah.
slept and I was so sick?
Yes.
That was my experience, my yes. first ever experience with wet gangrene.
Yes.
Me as a nursing student, and all I did was help the nurse hold a leg.
Yes.
I helped hold the leg while mm-hmm. the nurse did the dressing, wrapped the legs. And I went, when we were done, I went into the hallway. I ended up sitting on the floor. I was white as a ghost. That smell stayed with me 20 years later.
For those of that have never smelled it, I mean, it essentially smells like death.
Yeah.
Because it is
flesh.
Quite it's... literally rotten flesh.
Yeah.
And
wow.
It is very intense. It is very strong, and nothing you do makes it go away. Nothing you do can cover it up, and no dressings will hold that in.
No.
So Edith, unfortunately, was no exception.
Yeah.
She was, and you know, it's so unfortunate for this poor lady. So she was starting to call out in pain. So she's spending more time in bed. She's calling out in pain. She's extremely uncomfortable. She's calling out for hours and hours on end, which for me as the provider, I'm like, well, who the hell is like not controlling this lady's pain?
Yes,
what can,
yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes.
What can we do to get this lady comfortable?
Uh-huh.
But she was extremely uncomfortable, and the smell permeated this lady's room, and it
yeah.
was like you could smell it outside the room, all at the nurse's station. Like yeah. it was just that piece of it was unpleasant for
right.
people. So
poor Edith.
I know.
Poor
so.
Edith.
On April 7th, Gwen and Kathy took it upon themselves to smother Edith using washcloths to death in the same manner that they had taken the four previous lives. And later on, when they were interviewed about this, they shared that it was because they were sick of the odor and the yelling.
Who cares?
Which I just want to fucking karate chop these women. I want to karate chop them.
I despise
fuck
them.
You. You are the worst. Mm-hmm. You are the worst. The worst.
We've done a lot of stories. How many stories now? 50 something?
Six. Yeah, something like that.
And I've hated a lot of our people on the show.
Mm-hmm. These but two are special,
these
though.
These two are harming the people that I'm devoting so far 20 plus years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
Oh, there is a special place this in one's hell hard. For you.
Yes.
There
yes.
is a special place in hell for you.
Exactly. So Kathy was, again, super psyched about this murder. Really wanted to relive it again with Gwen and was hoping that this would, like, bring them closer together. Like, again, they're just saying this stuff is, like, so sick. Like, what? Like, you guys should really be very alarmed with yourselves if this is what you have to do to, like, get psyched about
I
each
mean,
other. Like, like, that's a big problem. I don't yeah. know if you know this, but that is a fucking huge problem.
Wow.
So.
I don't know if you know this.
I don't know if you know this.
Red flag.
I don't know who needs to hear this. Red flag guy. Have you seen Red Flag Guy on TikTok?
No.
Oh my God, he's so fucking funny.
Oh God. Okay.
Anyway, look him up. Red Flag Guy. So Kathy was super psyched about this. Gwen was less excited about it because she's like starting to be over this whole thing. She's
I mean,
like,
I would hope so.
I mean, I feel like it shouldn't take
like
five dead people.
She should have been over it the first time it was suggested.
It should not take five dead people for this. So she's like over this and she starts pulling away. And actually around this time, she starts having an affair with another woman by the name of Janet Sawyer. Janet was a 20-year-old resident of Grand Rapids, and the two had met through mutual friends. They had this initial, like, flirtatious relationship, which eventually blossomed into this mutual attraction, and the two start becoming a little bit more serious as we enter, like, the spring of 87. So there was one rendezvous that they had wherein Gwen and Janet met up in the parking lot of a supermarket. Janet saw that Gwen was upset about something and asked what was bothering her. And Gwen sobbingly confesses to having killed multiple people at the nursing home she works at. Janet didn't believe her. Blew her
oh
off,
my God,
said,
I'm
I don't
tired
believe
of people not believing them.
I know, stop. Look at me right now.
Here's your PSA.
Look at me right now.
Your PSA.
If someone tells you, hey, I have something to tell you, I fucking murdered someone, tell
someone,
literally anyone, please take it seriously. Please.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. This has been Murdery People with Kate and Devin.
This is Daily PSA with Kate and Devin.
Oh, God. So Janet doesn't believe her, blows her off, and says, ah, she's just fucking around. Which, the whole situation, like, I'm sobbingly confessing to you, and, like, how is that? Anyway, I don't know. So May of 1987 is when Kathy gets promoted at work.
To what?
Charge tech, which is essentially a supervisor of the LNAs. Pickens are slim, clearly. Pickens are very slim. Sorry.
I'm not laughing,
no.
obviously, at this story.
The
Please
absurdity.
Do not take that wrong.
The absurdity is what we're laughing at.
Wow.
So this was not greatly received with the rest
I mean,
of the staff.
There's slim pickings, and then there's just downright dumb.
Yeah. There was a lot of that in this situation.
Okay.
Downright dumb. So Kathy is known with the staff of being like a little bit of a bully. She likes to steamroll people. She likes to stir up drama.
Right.
She lies about things, like we talked about that all in part one. And she has been caught in a number of lies. Obviously, she was unprofessional. So a lot of the nurses and other CNAs are like, there's literally no one else. Like, literally anyone else.
There's me. Hi.
So she quickly becomes this like complete tyrant. So she's
dictator.
Yeah, total dictator. So she's verbally abusive to staff. She would put people down. She would go on a tear all around the building, essentially throwing her weight around like she's some huge fucking deal. And this actually seemingly threw this another rift between Kathy and Gwen, because now Kathy is Gwen's supervisor, right. Technically, right? And Gwen starts resenting Kathy for having gotten this promotion over her. And she said, like, out of the two of us, I'm definitely more management material. Everybody knows I work harder. I do a better job. I don't understand why Kathy is getting this position when she's so obnoxious and such a tyrant. So she starts, like, kind of resenting Kathy for this whole other reason now. So Gwen's opinion of Kathy at this point has gone, like, completely 180. So she is absolutely not into her anymore. She is ready to move on. There is still this weird layer of codependency between the two of them. Uh-huh. Like, they somehow just keep, like, reconnecting and keep coming back to each other. And it's like, but you guys can't even really be in the same room together at this point. Like, I don't get it.
No.
So it's at this point that Gwen abruptly quits Alpine Manor. She applies for this new temp position and seemingly, you know, is just hoping to completely disconnect herself from Alpine and from Kathy and all that drama at this point. So she starts this new job July 1st. So the relationship between Gwen and Kathy finally culminates in this incident in which both of them had a lot to drink. They had taken some drugs and the two of them were riding in Kathy's truck. And while the truck was moving, a fist fight breaks out. And this is never a good situation. Gwen apparently jumped out of the moving vehicle.
Not advised.
No, this is, do not try this at home. Jumps out of the moving vehicle. Kathy stops her truck, chases her down, and it drags Gwen back to the truck. The two apparently made
this
it back.
This sounds like a movie.
This is real life. This really happened between two human beings. This is a real thing that happened. This happened. And apparently the two made it back to one of the residences, and essentially this was the end of their relationship. Like, it should have ended a long time before any of this. Way before any of this. Right after this, Gwen moves out of Kathy's house and into Janet's house. Janet is the new girlfriend.
Yes.
Kathy did not take this well. She was seen on multiple occasions driving by Janet's residence that Gwen had moved into, was constantly calling her, constantly showing up at her work, just very obsessive, very toxic, all that behavior that is just red flaggy, red flaggy.
Right.
One morning, Gwen woke up and found Kathy standing at the foot of her bed. Huh? Like an absolute fucking psycho. Standing at the foot of her bed, staring at her, watching her sleep.
No.
That's a hard pass.
Yeah.
That's a hard no. So, didn't end up doing anything. I think they, you know, she left, but
other
Jesus.
Than breaking into where she now lives.
There's
and
that.
Watches her sleep at the foot of her bed.
Yeah, like, the fuck? I don't know, man. These women are a lot. So Gwen was starting to get really uneasy about staying in Michigan with Kathy around for obvious reasons. Kathy is, like, on top of her shit all the time. And her behavior was starting to escalate. Like, she just was watching me sleep. What was she gonna, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
So she makes plans to move back to Texas to get away from Michigan and hopefully put this whole thing behind her permanently and hopefully forget about the fact that she helped murder a bunch of people and like hope that no one ever figures that out.
Right.
So before she moves, Kathy is somehow given the opportunity to talk to Gwen alone. I don't know what transpired to allow this, but nobody knows what was said during this conversation. But by the end of it, Gwen packs up her stuff and instead of moving to Texas, moves back into Kathy's house.
Stop it. No way.
Two women are so codependent and so toxic. It's like the grossest.
But I love you.
Let's not give up on us.
God.
Just stop. Ladies.
I mean,
people are dead because of you. Stop.
Yes.
So what she told Janet when she moved out of Janet's was that, quote, Gwen has something on me and I can't leave her. So that infers that Kathy was like, bitch,
I got something on you.
I will tell the world what happened.
Wow.
And we will both go down for this in flames, or you can move back in with me and we can keep this secret forever.
Wow.
The following gets graphic. We are going to discuss an episode of sexual assault that is a lot. So fast forward the next like 30 seconds or so if that's too much. Apparently, when they got back to Kathy's home, it's reported that they engage in sexual intercourse. Kathy ties Gwen up, as they have before, but this time Kathy takes things way too far. And according to Gwen, Kathy sexually assaulted Gwen with a hunting rifle, despite her saying no and asking her to stop.
What?
Yes.
Now does Gwen leave?
Well, after this episode, Gwen had another change of heart, leaves Kathy, goes back to Janet's house, and tells her, I really need to get out of this situationship.
And, situationship?
Yep.
Love that.
I know. And I know she has things on me, but I cannot stay with her. She's hurting me.
Wow.
She's abusing me. She's raping me. Like, I can't do this.
Oh, my goodness.
So she and Janet together make plans to move to Texas again. And just, look, give me some time to smooth things out and over with Kathy so she doesn't go absolutely ballistic again. And so she hopefully doesn't tell on us and whatnot.
Dear.
And then you and I, we are going to go pack up our shit and we're going to move to Texas and be done with this. Hoping to just bury everything in the past.
But.
In early August, Gwen leaves for Texas with Janet.
Okay.
Now, in part one, I mentioned that there was a phone call between Kathy and her ex-husband, Ken. Mm-hmm. And this is that phone call. This is when that phone call takes place. So she calls up Ken. The two of them have sort of a working relationship because of they have the
Jamie,
daughter.
Yeah.
She tells him over the phone that this whole big relationship just ended. She's devastated. And that the two of them had, quote, killed six people together, end quote. These girls had confessed to other people before, to other people in their friend circle, and Gwen's new girlfriend, Janet, and it had been dismissed completely as having been a prank.
Come on, Ken.
But Ken knows his ex-wife very well.
Yeah.
And he knows that what she's saying is true.
Oh my God. He says,
I know this has to be true. He's trying to get her to be like, that, you know, is there any way that this was maybe an accident or maybe you were manipulated? And like, is there any way? She does reiterate that, yes, I was manipulated by Gwen. Gwen was the puppet master in all of this. And this is the point at which she says, you know, maybe it's that you thought these people were suffering and you were trying to end their suffering.
No.
And you did this to relieve people of existing with Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And she responded with, no, that's not true at all. We did it because it was fun.
So Ken does what?
After the phone call, he invites Kathy over to talk about it more. And she comes over. She continues to confess more details and just pouring everything out onto Ken. He immediately knows that she is telling the truth. He's like, there's no way this level of detail is all
right,
a lie.
Right.
He knows she lies and elaborates and confounds. He knows that about her, but he's like, there's no way. So she tells him about their plan to spell out the word murder that they had to abandon. And then the phrase that they use. She tells him about the washcloth. She tells him about the attempts that weren't successful. She tells him everything. And in Kathy's narrative, again, it's Gwen's idea. It's Gwen driving this.
Save me, help me.
Save me, help me. Gwen made me do this. Gwen killed everybody while I was the lookout, and I didn't actually kill anybody. It's thought that this was the last ditch effort for Kathy to kind of try and control Gwen, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. Gwen had left her for another woman. She was angry. She was hurt, and she was doing exactly what she said she was going to do, which is blow this whole thing out of the water.
Right.
But he initially responds with saying, listen, you need help. Obviously, you need help. Please let me call someone. We're going to call the authorities. I'll go with you. We're going to tell somebody about all of this, and they're going to get you the help that you need. Clearly, there's something going on. You need mental health support. This is not normal. Let me help you.
Mm-hmm.
She responds angrily and tells him, if you call the police, I'm going to kill myself.
Oh, come on.
Some
Please tell
more,
me he does it anyway.
More grandiosity, more manipulation.
Right.
So, for true fear that she would hurt herself, Ken makes the initial decision to keep the secret for to himself, just for the time being, so that he can kind of continue to get some more information and see if he can kind of feel out what the right next move is. So, the first initial like week or so, he keeps the secret now. Gwen had cut Kathy off completely, but while in Texas, she starts panicking because she has just left Kathy, and Gwen starts getting concerned that Kathy is going to do something to expose what they did.
Right.
So she knows, and it occurs to her, like, shit, There's like actual documents. We write letters and poems to each other all the time that talk about the killings and talk about.
Oh my gosh.
And she's like, Kathy has
all. That's all been left behind.
Kathy has all of that. So I literally have written confessions that Kathy has. So this is not so good for me. So she starts realizing that she could easily turn those into authorities and essentially have confessions incriminating both of them.
Yeah.
Ken, like I said, keeps Kathy's secrets initially. It sounds like it was like a week or two max during this time. This entire time, he's trying to convince her to seek mental health help, trying to convince her, please don't hurt yourself. I don't want my daughter to be without a mother. Don't hurt yourself. We can get you help and we can make this right. We can do the right thing here. She keeps perseverating on the fact that she is going to hurt herself and manipulates the shit out of him to try and keep quiet. So on it occurs to him that, you know, I think the thing about her threatening to commit suicide, he's like, I don't think she's going to do it. I think she's saying that to try to scare me into being quiet.
Right.
So when he's pretty confident at some point that she's like sort of bluffing about that, he makes the decision to risk it and to contact the authorities.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank
finally,
you.
Ken. Finally, somebody fucking takes something. Thank you, Ken. We like you, Ken. On October 6, 1987, Ken Wood walks into a police station in the town of Wyoming, Michigan, and asks to speak to an officer regarding the statements Kathy had made. And he sat down with Detective Tom Freeman, and he tells him everything. The next day, October 7th, Detective Freeman picked up Kathy from Alpine during a work shift and brought her in for questioning. During questioning, Kathy was aloof and didn't seem nervous or upset at all, and in fact didn't seem to want to take anything seriously and thought this was all stupid. When he asked about the allegation, she dismissed everything as a practical joke. I was joking.
What?
Did Ken think I was serious? Because it was a joke. Detective Freeman did not buy it, thankfully, and went ahead with securing a search warrant for her property. When authorities told Kathy that they were going to begin poring over medical records from Alpine, she started to dial back on the aloofness and started to talk. And told them about her relationship with Gwen, and that Gwen was the puppet master. And that Gwen had manipulated Kathy into being the lookout while Gwen murdered every single one of them. Which I doubt.
Bullshit.
Bullshit. She did everything she could do to ensure that Gwen looked like the evil, manipulative, abusive one, and Kathy was the victim in this scenario. So, Alpine was ordered to turn over volumes of medical records, and poring over this was probably a massive undertaking, because, as we said, everything gets documented. There's a huge paper trail with literally everything that they did. And what they were trying to do was obviously build a timeline of the deaths and correlate between when the ladies were working and was there a paper trail between when they worked and when the patients died. So detectives get Kathy to write out her statement. And October 9th, Kathy was suspended from Alpine pending an investigation. On October 12th, Detective Freeman and his associates flew down to Tyler, Texas, which is where Gwen had recently relocated, with a warrant to hand in to in hand to search Gwen's home, initially to search Gwen's home and question Gwen. On questioning, once the names of the victims were mentioned, she immediately lawyered up. And she clammed up she wouldn't give them anything without their lawyer, without her lawyer. So press gets a hold of this, and the articles...
Can't blame her, because you also don't know... Well, number one, she knows she's guilty. But also, like, she's been petrified about what Kathy's been saying all along anyway.
Exactly. So she's like, what do they have? I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So once press get a hold of this, the articles start pouring out. More employees and friends start coming out of the woodwork to sort of
weird
give
behavior
their...
of them. And,
yes, giving those accounts and their testimonies of the weird behavior, the toxic relationship. And then all of those confessions that nobody took seriously. Like, you know, they mentioned that they murdered people. I thought they were joking.
Come on, Janet.
Great. Come on, Janet.
Is Janet just baffled that it's true?
I know, right? Jesus. October 27th, Kathy is questioned again. And this is when they go into when Kathy starts going into how they started selecting their victims, that they wanted to spell out the word murder, but then had to abandon that. And that they were stealing things from their victims as souvenirs. And after their arrests, staff who socialized with Gwen and Kathy outside of work who were interviewed actually told stories about how the women had admitted to smothering patients and that they were never taken seriously, that they did that, and how much they would drink and do drugs outside of work and how they were just super dysfunctional as human beings. And
they got promoted.
They also had one friend who noticed that, hey, Gwen and Kathy, you guys have a whole shelf full of belongings that I know belong to the residents. Like, I've seen that with so-and-so. So they were stealing things to take as souvenirs and putting them up on a shelf.
It's their trophy shelf.
Yeah. So that's, like, some real messed up shit. So as they continue to question the ladies, it seems like the number of victims kind of keeps changing. So first it was 6, and then it was 8, and then it was 5. Nevertheless, they finally had enough evidence to bring charges against them. So on December 4th of 1988, they were arrested and charged for the murders of Edith Cook and Marguerite Chambers. So with those two, they were able to make direct links and were hoping to sort of build cases as they prepared for the trial. So Gwen was formally arrested on that day in Texas and was extradited back to Michigan for this. Kathy, being the conniving piece of shit she is, takes a deal.
Gross.
Gross is right. And she said she will plead guilty and testify against Gwen to get her charges reduced. And we'll go into what the charges end up being. April 19th of 1989. There is a preliminary hearing in which Kathy takes the stand to testify against Gwen. Kathy, of course, is claiming that the murders were Gwen's idea.
Right.
Gwen was the most abusive one in the relationship. She was manipulative. And when asked why she went along with all this, she said she felt like Gwen was the first and only person to really understand me. I didn't want to risk losing the relationship.
Bullshit.
I know. The press covering the trial took that tidbit and like ran with it. And the news outlets describe the
people
pairs.
People can see past this, right? Please don't.
Oh, don't. Well, it doesn't end well.
Mm.
So describing the pairs. So papers start putting out this like lesbian love affair. And right, it's like right, all right. Very like, you know. Yeah.
Headlines.
Like headlines like this, you know, lesbian love bond. And Gwen was in the courtroom as Kathy gave this testimony throughout. And she showed absolutely no emotion for this testimony. So Don Mayo, who was a very close friend of the two and Kathy's ex-girlfriend, takes the stand to give her account of the pair's relationship, the confession that she ultimately didn't believe, the toxic behavior, the unprofessionalism, all of that. And interestingly, while Don was describing an altercation that she and the ladies had together, Gwen started giggling uncontrollably. And this was like one of the only times she showed any emotion during the whole trial. She just like started laughing weirdly at this moment. And we start like learning a little bit more about like Gwen's mental state, and we'll get into it. So Gwen's behavior continued to strike people as odd, even just like while hanging out in prison. There was one time actually when her attorney came to visit her and he found her yelling and crying in her cell and stating that she was terrified that she was being sucked into the toilet.
I mean, I'm terrified of that too.
You should be.
Quite frankly.
It's a very real danger.
Yeah.
So
poop monsters.
But this is like a delusion,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Like a psychosis.
Yes.
So this was like more than just your average being a weirdo.
So do you think obviously she's going to be deranged at some point to participate in all of this with Kathy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no question about that you got something wrong mentally and you're going through some disorder. Whatever it is, clearly exacerbated by the stress of being arrested, on trial.
Yes.
She going psychotic now?
Right.
Like,
we'll talk about it. So Kathy and her team start using Gwen's instability and poor mental health to their advantage, of course, because why wouldn't we, right?
Yep.
So Kathy just keeps reiterating that it was Gwen's idea to kill, and Kathy just went along with it and attempting to garner all this sympathy with the jury. And it was later observed that one day that Kathy was like passing by Gwen in her cell because they were being held at the same institution. And Kathy was seen pointing and laughing at Gwen in her cell, like taunting her.
Great.
Mm-hmm. So Gwen now takes the stand, and she denies killing anybody. She says, nope, I was the lookout. Kathy did all the killing. And with every single one of the victims. And that's, you know, it was all this stupid joke that got out of hand.
Of course, now it's a he said, she said.
Exactly. So, like, the truth lies somewhere in between, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't know the exact truth of what happened.
Yeah.
On September 20th, 1989, the jury deliberated for just 6 hours before Gwen Graham was found guilty on a total of 5 counts of murder, 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder, and was given life sentences for each of the 5 counts of murder and a life sentence for the conspiracy without the possibility of parole. So Gwen is getting put the fuck away for this.
She deserves it.
Yes.
She deserves it.
So
how about the other one?
When she was read the verdict, Gwen had no reaction whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Kathy had taken the deal and pled guilty to avoid her trial altogether, pleading guilty to conspiracy to commit murder and second degree murder. So she was having lesser charges, and she got sentenced to only 20 to 40 years in prison with the possibility of parole.
Because technically that's like right now. Like if she hit the 40 years.
She
like
was released like in 2019.
What the? Come on!
She is among us.
Come on!
She walks among
no
us.
No way!
I shit you not. Yep. Well, what? Gwen is still in prison for the rest of her life.
Wow.
While in prison, Kathy was reported by fellow inmates to take pleasure in manipulating people in an effort to gain money, toiletries, clothes, and other prison commodities. She was also accused of sexually and physically bullying and abusing other inmates. And even started bragging about the case, openly admitting that she committed the murders on her own and framed Gwen and got her put away for life, taking advantage of her suggestibility just to get back at Gwen for flirting with other women and leaving her for other women. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Who knows if that's a little bit of grandiosity or if that's true. Maybe a little of both. Now, Gwen, while in prison, agreed to psychological evaluation because, again, she's having these episodes of, like, delirium.
Mm-hmm.
So she was found to have low-functioning borderline personality disorder. So she has a psychiatric diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And experts actually state that with her level of cognitive functioning during this time, it would not have been possible for her cognitively to manipulate Kathy or to plan to the degree that that took or to cover things up.
Right.
She literally did not have the capacity to do that.
Yep.
So what Kathy had testified more than likely was utter bullshit.
Right, right.
And it is far more scientifically likely
that Kathy is a sociopath?
Kathy is a sociopath, manipulated the shit out of Gwen, and Gwen probably did some things.
Of course, yes. She is not guilty. She is not innocent in this. Excuse me.
A lot of people have bipolar disorder, and most of them don't murder people. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving her an excuse. I'm just giving you some insight into her state, and that she is far more likely, it is far more likely that she was very impressionable and very easily manipulated, according to psychiatrists.
Yeah.
So, tough to say, again, where the actual truth is. It's somewhere in the middle of all this. None of us know. But on October of 2019, Kathy Wood was granted parole at age 59. And she moved to South Carolina, where she lives with her sister. She is barred from ever working in healthcare. I mean, at a fucking minimum. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Gwen Graham, to this day, remains in prison.
Wow. Wow. I was not anticipating you telling me that Kathy was out.
And Gwen will rot in prison.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm. This was such a heavy one. My God. Thank you guys for watching and for listening. This has really been a tough one. Let us know what you think.
If any of you work in long-term care like Kate and I do.
If you have a resident that you just, that's your ride or die, tell us. We want to know.
Oh my gosh.
We want to know about your ride or die.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've had a few ride or dies.
Also, it doesn't matter if they're your ride or die or not. They don't deserve that treatment.
No.
Yeah.
No. But you know what? You can't work in the industry that we do. You know, I mean, obviously in every aspect of healthcare, you get attached in some way to who you're caring for,
mm-hmm.
whether it's for a few hours in the ER that they impact you, or for years mm-hmm. in long-term care, they yep. impact you. But when you just get to know someone as they are now, mm-hmm. you know, because some of them are very different than when they were younger.
Right? Yes.
It's just, there's nothing like it.
Yes.
There's nothing like it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for listening, everybody. If you want to keep hearing more from us and seeing what we're up to, you can look for us on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast. You can search for us on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you want to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/MedCrimesPodcast.
If you want to interact with us, send us any of your crazy stories, any headlines or any topics that you would love us to cover, you can email us at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Good job.
No www.
That's a good save.
Just email us yes. at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Also, just rate, review, subscribe, share, like, all that good stuff.
And find us on YouTube.
Woo, it's fun here.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye-bye.